Good morning. In the matter of Jed Goldfarb versus David Salamini, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Christina Malfi from Gibbons for the petitioner.
Good morning, Your Honors. Andrew Moskowitz from Javerbaum Morgaft on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, Jed Goldfarb.
John W. Green of Green Savitz for Amicus Mealy, New Jersey.
Good morning, counsel. We have some technical difficulties such that Ms. Amalfi will be participating by phone and not with the video, and thank you for agreeing to continue. Ms. Amalfi, please proceed, and I'd ask everyone who's not speaking or asking questions to hit the mute button.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
That's fine.
As a registered investment advisor, Jed Goldfarb was professionally obligated under the New Jersey Uniform Securities Law to ensure that any agreement for investment services with any investor, big or small, be in writing. The New Jersey Securities Law makes no distinction between an investment advisor who is employed for a salary or one who works on a commission. It makes no distinction between a large investor or a small investor. The New Jersey Securities Law protects all investors in this state and obligates the investment advisor, not the investor, to ensure that specific terms and conditions of his investment services are set out in writing and agreed to by the investor. In fact, the statute prohibits the investment advisor from seeking remuneration of any type from any investor if there is no written agreement. The statute also provides that no person who has made a contract in violation of the statute, an oral agreement, for example, may base any suit on that contract. Here, Mr. Goldfarb, a well-trained lawyer with years of experience in financial services, clearly could have and should have prepared an investment services agreement, and he could have and he should have arranged for execution of that agreement by Mr. Salamini. But in this case, Mr. Goldfarb failed to meet this basic obligation under the New Jersey statute. He did not set out the specifics of his services for Mr. Salamini to consider. He did not include a writing with all the specific terms and conditions that are required by the New Jersey Securities Law. This case would not exist if he had done so. Mr. Goldfarb should not now be rewarded for failing to follow the clear directive of our legislature that consumers of this state must be afforded the protection of a written agreement. Indeed, the very filing of this suit, which is clearly based on an illegal oral contract, is a violation of the New Jersey Securities Act. The appellate division below absolved Mr. Goldfarb of his professional obligations under the New Jersey Securities Law. The appellate division held that Mr. Goldfarb's claim did not run afoul of the New Jersey Securities Law's writing requirement because he did not base his suit on the alleged oral contract, but instead on a claim of promissory estoppel. Tellingly, the appellate division cited no case for the proposition that a professional who was obligated to prepare an agreement in writing consistent with a consumer protection statute can avoid that obligation by simply entering into an oral agreement and then seeking damages based on a claim of promissory estoppel. No case was cited by the appellate division because no such case exists. In addition, and critically, the appellate division completely ignored this court's holding in McCann versus Bliss. In McCann, this court made clear that a real estate broker who was obligated to put the agreement in writing could not evade the statutory requirement that the broker's agreement with the homeowner be in writing based on a claim premised on the broker's reasonable expectation obtained through an alleged oral agreement. This court found that to enforce an oral agreement would undermine the letter and spirit of the consumer protection statute. This court aptly noted that brokers are professionals. It is not unfair to deprive them of compensation if they do not adopt the safeguards of which they should be aware. The reasoning of McCann applies equally to this case. The appellate division's decision here provides that an investment advisor can circumvent the writing requirement of the New Jersey Securities Law by simply framing his claim as one of reliance on an alleged oral agreement. This holding flies directly in the face of McCann and the plain language, spirit, and policy of the New Jersey Securities Law. The appellate division also absolved Mr. Goldfarb of his obligations under the securities law, finding that a family office exclusion included under federal law exempted him from New Jersey statute's writing requirement. Indeed, the appellate division's decision would exclude Mr. Goldfarb from all of the New Jersey securities law's requirements. First, as the legal arguments in our brief make clear, the federal family office exception that was relied upon by the appellate division has not been incorporated into the New Jersey securities law and thus has no applicability to this case at all. Second, even if the federal family office exception was incorporated into the New Jersey statute, the jury below was never asked to and accordingly never found the existence of a family office or that Mr. Goldfarb was going to work for a family office. Indeed, the appellate division usurped the jury's function as to this factual determination through the improper exercise of original jurisdiction. While we all understand the appellate division's concerns regarding the conduct of the trial judge, the court went well beyond where it should have gone when fashioning its remedy here. Indeed, the overreach of the appellate division was further exacerbated by the fact that Mr. Solomon never had an opportunity to present evidence on the family office, since its applicability to the circumstances here was first raised by Mr. Goldfarb after the verdict. For these reasons, it's respectfully submitted that the appellate division's decision should be reversed and judgment entered for the petitioner, David Solomon. That completes my opening statement. Turning to the appellate division's decision that Mr. Goldfarb...
Counsel, if I may interrupt for just a moment, this is Justice LaVecchia.
Thank you.
I would agree with you if this plaintiff was seeking a typical contract remedy of securing the benefit of the bargain that did not occur. But this is a promissory estoppel claim that's seeking reliance damages, which is different. It's not undermining, in my view, what it is that the Securities Act seeks to bar, which is bringing an action based upon performance of the contract. It's a different kind of damage. And let's put it in this context. In trying to put himself in the position he would have been had he never met the defendant, but he had this plaintiff had moved because the job he thought was going to require it, would you be disputing that he could bring reliance damages for the costs of moving, selling his home and moving to another location as a result of this broken promise?
Justice LaVecchia, I think the issue of moving and relying upon an oral employment agreement was addressed by the court, if I recall, in the D'Agostino case. And the difference between that case and this case is that here there's a statutory requirement that Mr. Goldfarb could not provide investment services. He could not take that job to provide
damages based on that job, Ms. Amalfi. As I understand the damage claim, he is asking for the difference between what he made in his prior job that he quit and what he was able to secure when he found replacement employment after this job with defendant did not materialize. That's different than trying to secure contract damages for this contract that did not have a written aspect to it, which I agree is in violation of the securities law. So it seems to me we're dealing with something entirely different and not like McCann. If we focus on the nature of the damages that this plaintiff is seeking to obtain through the promissory estoppel claim, I don't see this action as running afoul of McCann or running afoul of the literal language of the securities law. Can you help me with that?
Yes, I can. First of all, let me suggest to you that Mr. Goldfarb made dozens of factual allegations under the heading Facts Common to All Claims for Relief in his complaint. And he alleged quantum merit, he alleged promissory estoppel, he alleged contract damages.
Quantum merit is no longer in this case. We're focused on the reliance damages, so let's stick with what we have.
Yes. So the securities law would provide that an investment advisor needs to have a rating and can obtain no compensation, none. It doesn't matter if he frames it as reliance damages or he frames it as contract damages. He shouldn't be able to get any
damages. It makes a big difference, doesn't it, counsel? Because he's not looking for the benefit of the bargain of the job that he didn't get with defendant. He's looking to obtain reliance damages as a result of this promise of employment never materializing and working out. So he changed his position. He's not looking to get the benefit of the bargain. I just don't see how you can make that argument.
Well, but he can't get the benefit of the bargain because the bargain was he was going to provide investment advice. And that bargain by statute is required to be in writing. So he can't get the benefit of the bargain.
No dispute about that. My questioning is focusing on the fact that I do not perceive his claim to be based upon a benefit of the bargain.
We clearly here see a case which is unique where the plaintiff was the one who was obligated to get the writing. He couldn't begin this job. He couldn't take this job. He couldn't provide the investment advice without the writing. Under McCann's holding, you can't allow that person who was obligated, that plaintiff who had the obligation to get around the statute by saying, oh, no, I'm not suing on the contract. I'm suing on a promissory estoppel theory. My client, Mr. Solomine, would have no idea if it needed to be in writing or not. It's Mr. Goldfarb who had the obligation and the knowledge to know that it should have been in writing. And it's our view that under – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'll finish your answer, please.
Well, under the securities law specifically speaks to the fact that there can be no compensation, no compensation. And so here he is seeking compensation. He's seeking compensation based on – what he says is an oral promise that supports his promissory estoppel claim, but the oral promise is the oral agreement for investment services.
So put the facts of this case to one side. As you understand the law, does it afford any relief under any theory to a person who's received a clear oral promise that they will have a job as an investment advisor, reasonably relies on that, leaves their job, and then suffers a demonstrable loss when the promise is not kept?
My position would be no.
And is there anything in the law then that would deter that kind of false promise?
Well, you would presume, the law should presume, that an investment advisor knows of his obligations and understands that he cannot rely on a promise without a writing. What the appellate division allowed Mr. Goldfarb to do is to just walk away from the fact that there had to be a writing here.
Ms. Moffitt, I take it your position is that the securities law is a consumer protection law. It was written and intended to protect the consumer and to place upon the investment advisor the requirement of placing the terms of the agreement in writing. That's what the legislature said. And I take it your position is equity follows the law. Our court doesn't have the authority to use its equitable principles to undermine this writing requirement.
Absolutely. Sure. And sometimes our law has very black letter laws, and sometimes the enforcement of those black letter laws, which this court is required to do, it turns out that it may not seem just or right under the circumstances. But the consumers of this state, the investors of this state, have every right to rely on the fact that the statute that was passed by this legislature and signed by our governor says you cannot provide investment services without a writing. And in fact, in McCann, the court said that the seller in that case was allowed to totally ignore the promise and could walk away from the promise because the promise needed to be in writing.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do we even know precisely who he was going to be working for? Was he going to be working for an individual or a company? Like, there's so many different family members and companies involved here. Go ahead.
That's correct. That's That's absolutely correct. So we know, and so that's moving over to the family office exception where we address that issue. But to be honest,
it also goes to the nature of whether or not there was even what sort of agreement there was, even
that's correct. It's our view that there was never a definite agreement here that should have been relied upon by Mr. Goldfarb. Mr. Goldfarb testified at the trial that he might work for Mr. Solomine, Mr. David Solomine. He might work for an insurance company called Core Insurance. He might work for Mr. Emil Solomine, or he may work for another company called DMS Global, or he may work for other businesses controlled by Mr. Solomine. He had no idea who he was going to be working for. In any case, no matter who he worked for, if he was providing investment advice, he needed to have it in writing. And equity should not save him from that, where you have a clear and unambiguous statute on this point.
If I can just stop you for a second. Before you were citing the statute, and I believe you were reading from NJSA 49.3-71H, which is, I think, the critical prohibition. It says, no person who has made or engaged in the performance of any contract in violation of this, of any provision of this act or any rule hereunder, may base any suit on the contract. I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but the prohibition seems focused on trying to secure a remedy off of the contract, which you're rightfully saying he could not deliver investment services without a written contract. I'm having still having a difficulty reading that language, which is the key prohibition in this case, as prohibiting a tort action based upon broken promises.
Well, we don't have a tort action here, respectfully. We have a promissory
Promissory estoppel action based upon reliance damages, which are not we're not seeking remuneration for investment services provided.
I would refer the court to Section 49.3-53, which has prohibited practices relative to the investment advisor. And in that section, it says, it shall be unlawful for any person who receives, directly or indirectly, any compensation for any from another person for advising the other person as to the value of the securities or their purchase or sale. And then it goes on to say, to engage in dishonest or unethical practices as the borough chief may by rule define. The borough chief has defined it a dishonest and unethical practice for a investment provider to enter into a contract that is not in writing. So you can't allow.
He didn't do that here, did he?
He says that there was a promise, and as a result of that, he's entitled to a verdict on promissory estoppel. The restatement
Ms. Malfi,
if that's the case, yes.
Ms. Malfi, maybe you can clarify this. For me, this is your exchange with Justice Lavecchia. Is promissory estoppel a tort action or a quasi-contractual action that is grounded in equity, which is what I thought promissory estoppel is. Maybe I'm mistaken.
You are absolutely correct.
So
it's
not
estoppel.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead for
the technical issue here. Promissory estoppel is a quasi-contract action, very similar to quantum merit. It's an equitable principle. Promissory estoppel. There is no case, there is no precedent in this state where someone proceeded on a quasi-contract cause of action, whether it be quantum merit or promissory estoppel, who had an obligation to put something in writing and who did not do it. There's no case in the state which allows that person to walk away from the statutory requirements and to recover damages. There's no case.
Promissory estoppel is much like any other kind. It's a promise in exchange for another promise, which is your basic contract. This is placed as an equitable remedy in certain cases where there isn't necessarily a statutory writing requirement. Am I correct?
Yes, that is correct. And the promissory estoppel issue, it comes out of the restatement. And interestingly, in the restatement, in particular, Section 90 of the restatement, Comment D, there it says that if you plead a successful promissory estoppel cause of action, as a matter of equity, they find a contract exists. And so if you find a contract exists, then the contract needs to be in writing consistent with the New Jersey Securities Act. You cannot, through an equitable cause of action, in this case promissory estoppel, or a quasi-contract cause of action, in this case promissory estoppel, you can't walk away and be absolved from the writing requirement. If Mr. Goldfarb entered into a writing with Mr. Solomon, we would not be here. The writing would have been clear, and the writing would have then set forth the terms and conditions of his investment services. That was never done, and it was his obligation, not Mr. Solomon's obligation, under the law to do that.
Miss Amalfi, that's another factual question. Forget about the writing requirement. Do we know whether or not there was even an oral agreement in terms of the percentage that the plaintiff would have received for his investment services above his salary? Was that ever determined?
No. Many of the terms of the alleged oral agreement were never finalized or determined. So there was testimony in the record that he was going to get between 15% and 20%. That's a big difference between 15% and 20% of profits. There's testimony in the record he was going to be paid $250 or $275. He wasn't sure. So the terms and conditions of the actual compensation he would receive for providing the investment advice, which by the way is required to be in writing under the statute, were never agreed to between the parties, even in the alleged oral agreement that Mr. Goldfarb says occurred here.
So where in the statute do you glean support for the fact that reliance damages are cut off as well? Reliance damages unrelated to remuneration that would have been provided under a contract had one ever been executed between these parties.
I would rely on NJSA 49-3-71, which prohibits any investment advisor from receiving compensation for investment services. I would rely on 49-3-53, which says it's unlawful for anyone directly or indirectly to get compensation from another person if they fail to get a writing. And I would rely upon the fact that the statute is a consumer protection statute where the letter and spirit and the legislature and legislative intent has been found by this court and other courts to clearly be in favor of the investor. It needs to be read in favor of the investor. It's to prevent the investor from having an investment advisor saying, we had an agreement, and now you owe me money. This investor had every right.
Let me stop you right there, Ms. Amalfi. It's that last couple of words in your answer to me that I keep coming back to. He's not looking for money, as I understand this demand, based on a calculation off of this contract. He's looking for different damages. He's looking for reliance damages that are calculated in an entirely different way. What in the statute prevents him from bringing this action for those reliance damages?
To allow him to bring this action for those reliance damages would completely undermine and gut the writing requirement of the statute. The intent of the statute is that these type of services cannot be provided without a writing. He was the party obligated to get the writing. He didn't get the writing. He had no right to have any reliance on anything because it was his obligation to get the writing. He didn't get the writing.
And I take it he provided no services to the defendant. He wound up leaving his job without getting a written agreement for employment or an agreement that he should have been writing, because typically the investment advisor is the person who prepares the contract. Am I right about that?
You're absolutely right. And the law makes clear, the statute makes clear, that it's the investment advisor who has the obligation to ensure that the writing is put in place. I'll just use by way of an example, as a lawyer, we're required as lawyers to get our retainer agreements in writing. Sometimes companies say, I'll send you a retainer agreement. That doesn't, and maybe it never comes. Maybe that retainer agreement never shows up. Well, it doesn't obviate my obligation as a lawyer to ensure, before I provide any services, that my services are in writing. And, you know, my fees are in writing, how much it's going to cost, what I'm going to do. Mr. Goldfarb stands in the same position, although in his case, it's even more pronounced because it's a statutory requirement as compared to a rule of professional conduct.
But okay. I know that this issue isn't before us, Ms. Amalfi, but quantum merit may be different from promissory estoppel. Do you agree? Go ahead.
Quantum merit may be different in that if someone actually engaged and provided services, courts have allowed quantum merit to proceed. Right. However, where there is a statutory consumer protection statute, courts have not allowed quantum merit claims to proceed. They've allowed tort claims to proceed. And so think about the tort claims that have proceeded. Those claims were based on things other than the contract.
I know we don't have to get the quantum error, but you brought up retainer agreements. And even when this court has found retainer agreements in violation of the law, we have still recognized quantum merit. Am I not mistaken?
That's the Starkey case. You're absolutely correct.
And not just the Starkey. There are other cases as well as recently as one that we decided this past year.
Yes, and this court has the right to enforce and interpret its rules of professional conduct any way it wants. It does not have the same discretion with regard to black letter law that's been passed by our legislature. Here, the black letter law passed by our legislature says it must be in writing. And as a result of that, under the Consumer Fraud Act, under the Securities Act, we have not, and under the real estate brokers statute, we have not seen this court or any court in the state allow quantum merit damages for that very reason. You certainly can do it in the context of your rules of professional conduct. I will note in the Starkey case that this court, under the rules of professional conduct, said you can't have your commission, you can't have your contingency arrangement, but we'll give you quantum merit. But here, there was no services performed. He's not entitled to be compensated for any services. So whether there was a quantum merit right or not, there were no services.
Right. Okay. I just threw it out. I know that quantum merit is not in the case. Thank you.
Ms. Amalfi, we're almost at the half hour. Would you like to briefly address the family office exception?
I would, very much. Thank you. The ruling of the appellate division was error for three reasons with regard to their finding that Mr. Goldfarb was absolved from compliance with the family, with the securities law because he was going to work for a family office. First, the family office exception has not been incorporated into the New Jersey securities law. Second, Mr. Goldfarb failed to carry his burden at trial to prove he was, in fact, promised employment with the family office. And the jury here made no determination on that fact. Mr. Goldfarb also waived the argument. Let me just briefly address the statutory construction issue. There are several categories of individuals under federal law that are exempted from the federal statute. The New Jersey securities law was enacted in 1997. At that time, the federal securities law section 202 did not exclude persons working for a family office from the definition. Family office wasn't even mentioned in 1997. The family office exception came to be in the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010. At that time, the family office exclusion was added to the federal law. Under well-settled principles of statutory construction, which have been adopted by this court, the exception cannot be part of the New Jersey securities law. And I would refer the court to Edward S., which says that the general rule is that when a statute incorporates another by specifically referring to it by title or section, only the precise terms of the incorporated statute as it then exists become part of the statute. Absent language to the contrary, subsequent amendments have no basis to be incorporated. Here, this is a very specific reference. It was not, the subsequent amendment was not incorporated. And I would just close by saying that twice in the very statute we're talking about, the New Jersey legislature specifically provided that amendments, subsequent amendments, should be included. And I would refer the court to the term, the definition of the term capital, which says net capital as defined and adjusted under the formula established by the SEC, and most importantly, quote, as such formula presently exists or as it may hereafter be amended, and also the definition of accredited investor, which is any person who's an accredited investor under the Federal Act, or, quote, any successor rule promulgated pursuant to the Act. As this court held in D. Prospero, it's not the function of the court to rewrite a plainly written enactment of the legislature or to presume that the legislature intended something that other than what is expressed in its plain language. In addition, the appellate division here took from the jury, even if you were to find that the family office exception existed, they took from the jury the factual question of whether this person was going to a family office or not. They made that decision with no citation to the record, and they, in essence, directed a verdict to Mr. Goldfarb on the fact that he was going to work for a family office, and therefore, from their perspective, he had no obligations under the New Jersey securities law. So for that reason, we would say that the family office exception does not apply, and even if the court found that it did apply, it was the jury never had an opportunity to make that factual finding, and it was an abuse of discretion for the appellate division using original jurisdiction to make that finding. It is clear.
Other questions?
I'm sorry. Does anyone have any additional questions? Please finish your thought, Ms. Amalfi, and try to bring the argument to a close.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. It is clear under this New Jersey securities law that entering into, extending, or renewing any investment advisory contract must be in writing. And it is a dishonest or unethical practice for anyone to seek compensation when that writing does not exist. Mr. Goldfarb is seeking compensation through a damages claim here, and to allow his claim to proceed under an equitable theory of promissory estoppel, a quasi-contract theory of promissory estoppel, would totally usurp the legislature's directive and would gut the New Jersey securities law to the detriment of consumer investors in the state. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Moskowitz.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Andrew Moskowitz on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, Jay Goldfarb. Your Honors, defendant is sought to rely on the Uniform Securities Law, but this case is not about the Uniform Securities Law. In the first sentence of its opinion, the appellate division articulated what the case is about. This is about defendant's broken promise to hire plaintiff to manage a portion of defendant's assets and those of his brother and father. Now, it's very important for this Court to remember what the Uniform Securities Law was created to do. It was to protect investors from investment advisors who engage in dishonest or unethical practices. It was not intended to immunize investors from liability for their own wrongful and dishonest conduct towards respective employees who, as in this case, exercised no control over individuals' investments. And moreover, there is nothing in the language of the Uniform Securities Law that indicates that it is intended to apply to a full-time employer-employee relationship. For this reason, if you have five clients or fewer, you're not required to register. In addition, the Uniform Securities Law contains a requirement that you may not be able to assign the contract without notifying the other party of a change in control of the investment advisor. That indicates that it's intended to apply to a corporate entity, not to an employer-employee relationship. But let's leave that aside. The fact of the matter is that Mr. Solomon should be equitably stopped from relying on any protections provided by the Uniform Securities Law. Counsel in her opening statement said that there's no case which has applied this type of principle, but that's incorrect. In the Digidio Landscaping versus Apicella case, Delsey Appellate Division 2001, 337 NJ Super 252. Its case is very similar to here, where the defendant said, we don't need a writing. We're friends, and we don't need a writing that complies with the Consumer Fraud Act. He then turned around and tried to say, well, you didn't give me a writing, so therefore you're barred by the Consumer Fraud Act. The Appellate Division rejected that result, and this court cited to that case in D'Agostino, but distinguished it factually. But it recognized the merit of that argument. Here, as I said, it is undisputed that Mr. Solomon repeatedly promised to provide Mr. Goldfarb with a written document memorializing the terms of the agreement, but then failed to do so. So the question, therefore, is whether the court intends to permit prospective employees who engage in such conduct to simply renege on a verbal promise and escape liability. And it's unquestioned that if so, it will fail to remedy, in the words of the Appellate Division, the injustice to defendants' false promises of employment and of providing written memorialization. Mr. Solomon comes before this court. He doesn't say that he was deceived by Mr. Goldfarb in any manner. He suffered no financial losses. To the contrary, by his own admission, his own testimony, he profited from Mr. Goldfarb's advice. Nevertheless, to exploit the absence of a writing that unquestionably arose due to his own conduct. That was the testimony at trial. He said, Mr. Goldfarb asked, did you send the term sheet? He said, yes, I did. I never got it. Can you send one? Well, I'm going on vacation. Don't worry about that. I'll send it when I get back. The failure to commit the terms of the agreement to writing was clearly the result of Mr. Solomon's conduct. And here he comes before the court and seeks to benefit from it. Clearly, permitting him to do so would be an inequitable result. In the alternative, if the court determines that the Uniform Securities Law is applicable, it should affirm the Appellate Division's holding that as an individual who sought employment with a family office, Mr. Goldfarb was not an investment advisor under the Uniform Securities Law. As set forth in our supplemental appendix, we first raised this defense in August 2014 in response to the defense motion to dismiss, and as defendant acknowledges, in response to its motion for a JNOV. The evidence at trial was that Mr. Goldfarb would have provided investment advisory services to his defendant, his brother, and his father. He would not have held himself out to the public as an investment advisor. There's therefore, Ms. Amalfi says this is a factual determination, but there's no genuine issue as to any material fact that would preclude the legal conclusion that the family office exception applied. With regard to this statutory challenge, defendants never raised this issue in the lower court. They didn't raise it in the Appellate Division. They never even raised it in their petition for certification. So I don't see how they can now claim the family office exception is not part of the Uniform Securities Law. Not finally, but with regard to damages, as much as defendant wishes that it were, this is not an action on an unwritten employment investor, on an unwritten advisory contract, or on an employment contract. Mr. Goldfarb has not sought to recover what he would have earned working for Mr. Solomon if Mr. Solomon had kept his promise. He has not sought to recover damages due to a breach of an agreement to provide investment advice. Therefore, this case differs from McCann. In McCann versus Biss, the plaintiff sought his commission. He reframed it as a claim for tortious interference or breach of implied contract, but he sought his commission. That's the damages he was seeking. Rather, the facts of this case are analogous to Peck versus iMedia and Popscones versus Resorts. And just responding to what Justice Albin said about the definite nature of the promise, in Peck, the plaintiff didn't have an employment contract, and in Pop's Cones, the plaintiff never signed a lease with the defendant. There's no question that there were terms, material terms of the agreement that had not been finalized. Nevertheless, in Pop's Cones, the Appellate Division noted the plaintiff was not seeking damages related to a lease of the boardwalk property. Rather, it saw damages flowing from its reliance upon promises made to it by the defendant. In this case, Mr. Goldfarb has sought reliance damages, consisting of the difference between what he would have earned had he not quit his job and what he ultimately earned after securing substitute employment. Counsel did not address the specific issue, but in their brief, they argued that we can't seek both reliance and benefit of the bargain damages. That's not what we're doing, and so therefore, I would submit we have not run afoul of comment D to section 90 of the restatement. And moreover, because Mr. Solomon is unjustly enriched, he may not seek to invoke the limitations on damages purportedly imposed by the restatement. Finally, on the issue of the appropriate remedy for the damage caused by an appearance of impropriety, I don't think there's any question anyone would dispute that there was an appearance of impropriety that was created here. Defendant's prior counsel engaged in ex parte communications with the trial judge, and the trial judge acknowledged that defendant's counsel, in her words, liked appearing before her. She then contacted the presiding judge and ensured that the case was assigned to her. These actions unquestionably tainted the proceedings with the appearance of partiality. Although this obliged the trial judge to recuse herself, she failed to do so. One of the rulings tainted by the appearance of impropriety was the trial judge's exclusion of plaintiff's damages expert. Here, in this case, the expert had testified at a Rule 104 hearing regarding the evidence upon which he relied and the standards employed in his analysis. Defendant has raised no challenges to his qualifications or his credibility. The public interest demanded an adequate remedy to restore public confidence in the tainted proceedings, and therefore the appellate division properly exercised its original jurisdiction. And I don't think that this court has to review that on abuse of discretion, and I don't think there's any question that, I don't think there's a legitimate argument that the appellate division did not act within its discretion. Happy to answer
the question. May I ask you a question, counsel, about the original jurisdiction point that you just raised? It appeared to me that the quarrel was over whether or not this was a net opinion. Do you regard the appellate division's exercise of jurisdiction here, which they describe as original jurisdiction, simply a review of whether or not this was a net opinion or something more?
I think that's right, Justice Slovakia. I mean, the appellate division framed it as original jurisdiction, but really they were reviewing a trial court's determination as to whether to exclude an expert's analysis. Here, there was a 104 hearing, and they looked at the evidence. There was, in the record, the evidence upon which he relied and the standards deployed and put in his analysis. The trial judge, in her opinion, barring the expert, cited to no case which provided that this opinion was a net opinion. Rather, she relied on the fact that plaintiff hadn't produced his tax returns. But in this case, I think really that was the question. Was it a net opinion? Here you had an expert who had testified in hundreds of cases. His qualifications were on question, and he described the documents that he relied upon.
But the question was whether or not relying on the W-2s without income tax returns would provide a proper basis for the opinion. So in that respect, was the appellate division treading on, I mean, at this point, the appellate division is sending the case back for a new trial on damages. Did the way in which this issue about the expert arose tread somewhat on the discretion that should have been left to the trial court if there is to be a new trial on damages?
I don't think it treaded on the trial court's discretion. I think it was a question of whether you have an expert who says he's qualified. He says these are documents that I typically rely upon. He testified that there are cases where he relies solely on W-2s. In this case, he testified that he relied on W-2s and in certain instances, tax returns, part of a tax return. He also testified he relied upon the employment contract that Mr. Goldfarb had with his subsequent employer. He reviewed a bank statement, which showed his bonus. He also reviewed the answers to his questionnaire where he requests an individual's earnings history. He testified that's what he relies upon, and the defendant proffered no expert to indicate that that was inappropriate or that some economic expert should not rely on those type documents. So I think the appellate division reviewed that and determined that the trial court was incorrect in finding that it was an opinion.
Are you asking the court to agree that a promissory estoppel action can be brought in this setting against the backdrop of this law only with respect to reliance damages that are unrelated to what the plaintiff's compensation would have been under the had there been an agreement ever executed between the parties? I'd like you to drill down on precisely the narrow form, I think, narrow form of damages that you're asking the court to permit to go forward.
Thank you. Here, we seek reliance damages based consisting of the difference between what Mr. Goldfarb would have earned had he not quit his job and what he ultimately earned after securing a substitute employment. Simply, it's as if the promise had never been made and he had stayed at his prior job. Mm-hmm. Simply reliance damages. We have not sought any compensation based on the investment advice that he provided to the defendant. Simply based on reliance damages.
And is it your position that that insulates it from running afoul of the prescription against seeking any action on the contract?
Well, because we're not bringing an action on a contract. The Uniform Securities Law is very simple, and I made this analogy in my brief. The Private Employment Agency Act says you can't bring any action. The Uniform Securities Law says you cannot bring an action for breach of an investment advisory contract. Here, that's not our case. There is a difference between a promissory estoppel claim and a breach of contract claim. There is a requirement in promissory estoppel that there be a clear and definite promise, but there can be instances where terms have not been finalized. And just responding to what Justice Alvin said, in Pops Cones, they said we're 95% there. As a result of that, they gave notice and they left their
lease. But here we have a statute, Mr. Moskowitz, which is, tell me if I'm mistaken, a consumer protection statute that is intended to protect the people who are getting advice from investment advisors. That's the purpose of the statute. Am I right about that?
You're right about that, Justice. But okay. I think there are two questions.
My next question is, was your client employed as an investment advisor?
He was never employed as an investment advisor by Mr. Solomon.
Was he? He was never employed, period, by Mr. Solomon.
That's correct.
Before his interaction with Mr. Solomon, was he employed as an investment advisor?
He was employed as a broker. He was employed in New York as a broker. And the testimony at trial that he didn't have a written agreement with his employer.
Employment. When your client was dealing with people receiving his advice, was he putting the agreement in writing or not? Was he complying?
I assume that the broker. There was no testimony at trial with regard to that, Your Honor. I would assume that the brokerage would have put the agreement in writing, and had some sort of writing which explained what the terms of the agreement was, but there was no testimony at trial as to that, Judge.
Yeah. Did your client at any time send to Mr. Solomon an email, a writing, summarizing the so-called agreement and saying, here's the agreement, this is what we agreed on? Did he ever do that?
He did not. He sent text messages to Mr. Solomon stated that there was a text exchange where he said, did you send the term sheet? I never received it. And Mr. Solomon said that he did. He then followed up with him in early July. And Mr. Solomon said, look, don't worry about that. We'll deal with that when I get back. Just go ahead and give notice. Mr. Goldfarb had no intention of beginning his employment without a written agreement, but then we never got there because Mr. Solomon reneged on his promise.
Typically, in this business, who submits the contract when there is an agreement to provide investment advice? Is it the consumer or is it the investment advisor? Who submits the contract?
I'd say typically it's the investment advisor, Judge, but here, this is an employer-employee relationship. It's a fundamentally different relationship. And as I said, that's why, Uniform Securities Law provides that you can't, if you're, it has specific language that must be in each contract. And it says you can't, you may not assign the contract without notifying the other party. It also, as I said, exempts from registration investment advisors who have five clients or fewer. That indicates it's intended to apply to a corporate entity, not to an employer-employee relationship. And as I don't mean to interrupt you, Judge, because I see you're about to speak. But this was looked at by the trial judge. This was looked at the appellate division level by very fine lawyers, two lawyers now for defendant. And they could never find an instance where it was applied, this law was applied in the employer-employee context.
Well, that assumes that there's an employee-employee, that there is an agreement, so that there is an employer and an employee. So I want to go to this, one of your earlier answers with respect to the family office exception. You said he was going to be advising the brother and the father. But tell me if I'm mistaken, the family office exception is for employment in a corporation. You're not employed by an individual by definition of this family office. Am I mistaken about that?
I don't have the family office exception statute in front of me, Judge, but as I recall, it says group of persons, including, it could be corporations, it could be a person. I don't have the statute right in front of me. But I think the key part of it is that you would not be holding yourself out public.
So I have the CFR in front of me. There may be other things. So this is 12 CFR section 275.202A. I'm not going to recite the rest of it, but I'll just begin reading that portion of the regulation. A family office is a company, including its directors, partners, members, managers, trustees, and employees acting within the scope of their position or employment. That, and then it goes on. So I haven't been able to find within that family office exception, assuming that it even applied, that covers investment advice for an individual as opposed to a company, falling within the family office exception. Can you cite to anything that would disabuse me of what I've just read to you? What I read to you may be incomplete. Maybe you have something further.
I know that the family office is set forth at 17 CFR 275.202. Is that what you just cited to, Your Honor?
Yes.
But my recollection is that it also includes a group of persons. But here, Judge, I think that by focusing on that,
it says it's a company. A family office is a company.
But I thought also says it includes its officers and directors, Your Honor.
Yeah, it does say that. Okay. Parenthetical, including its directors, partners, members, managers, trustees, employees, but it's a company.
Right, but at this
not
point,
a person.
I think the evidence.
I only raise this, Mr. Moskowitz, because you said he was going to be advising the brother and the father. Go ahead.
And why is that? I don't see the distinction there. I mean, Mr. Solomon, the one individual who did provide investment advice, Brian Marchetti, was employed by Core Insurance Holdings, and he was still providing investment advice to Mr. Solomon. So I think the fact that he would have Mr. Goldfarb would have provided investment advice to the brother and the father would not have precluded him from being employed by one of Mr. Solomon's companies, and I think that is what was contemplated.
Is there anything else you'd like to present, Mr. Moskowitz?
Your Honors, I just would like to emphasize the fact that I do not believe the Uniform Securities Law should be applied to a full-time employer-employee relationship, particularly here where there was no misconduct on the part of Mr. Goldfarb. And if the court permits it to do so, it will fail to remedy an injustice. And there was certainly no indication. I mean, at its core, the Uniform Securities Law 49353A3 says it's trying to prevent investor advisors from engaging in dishonest or unethical practices. And there was simply nothing in the record to demonstrate that Mr. Goldfarb engaged in such practices. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Green.
Good morning, Your Honors. While Ms. Amalfi made a very forceful case as to how the New Jersey securities law should apply, it basically relies upon, her argument relies on a false premise. And what she is doing is conflating a breach of contract claim with a promissory estoppel claim. I want to call the court's attention to the appellate division decision of Poxcone versus Resorts International. And I'm going to quote from 307 New Jersey Super at page 468. Now, in that case, the negotiations between Poxcone, who was going to, I guess, was going to get a supermarket type of business with Resorts International, they did, Poxcone and Resorts never finished their negotiations. They had a basic agreement, but did not nail down all the particulars. The trial court in that case dismissed on summary judgment on all claims. The appellate division reversed because Poxcone, the plaintiff, wasn't seeking breach of contract damages, expectation damages, or benefit of the bargain damages. It was seeking reliance damages. And I'm going to read you this quote. Thus, plaintiff's claim was predicated upon the concept of promissory estoppel and was not a traditional breach of contract claim. There are two distinct claims. So Ms. Amalfi is trying to do is cabin a promissory estoppel claim into a breach of contract claim. And I think Justice Levecchia hit it right on the head. They are two separate and distinct claims. If, in fact, you're going to say that a promissory estoppel claim comes within the statute, comes within the Jersey Securities Law statute, which says that you cannot enforce an oral contract, then what you're doing is effectively overruling not only Poxcone, but you're also effectively overruling Peck versus iMedia Court. That case is almost identical to this case. In Peck, the plaintiff gave up her business in Boston on the promise of coming to New Jersey to work for this company. Even more so than Mr. Goldfarb, she actually moved to New Jersey and worked for 10 days for iMedia Corp as a 1099 contractor. And then she was told, sorry, no job. The appellate division adopted a reliance damage remedy by saying she doesn't get the benefit of the bargain damages because she was cut loose or not even given a full-time job at iMedia Corp. She's entitled to the damages that she sustained by giving up her business in Boston. And that's
Mr. Green, the cases that you're citing us, do they involve statutes that require that the contract be in writing? Or were they consumer protect? No, did they involve consumer protection statutes?
They did not. However, Your Honor, there is a distinction because the New Jersey Uniform Securities Law, as the appellate division correctly pointed out, specifically says you cannot have an oral contract. So based on your question, Justice Alvin, is that you are then going to conflate a promissory estoppel claim, the elements of that claim, and a breach of contract claim.
I'm not trying to conflate anything. The suggestion is from Ms. Amalfi is, if it's not in writing and you're using the equitable principle of promissory estoppel, you're basically writing the writing requirement out of the securities law, and now you're permitting oral agreements, contrary to the will of the legislature. That's our argument.
I disagree with that argument in this regard. Mr. Goldfarb was getting no benefit from a promissory estoppel claim. He was merely being asked to be put in place to be restored to where he was based on a promise that was revoked. That's the whole premise of a promissory estoppel claim. And if you're saying that a promise is a contract, which is what Ms. Amalfi is saying.
It's a quasi-contract. Look, the statute says what it says. It says that promises between the investment advisor and the consumer have to be in writing. That's what it says. And you're using promissory estoppel to say, well, if it's not in writing and there's a promise by the consumer, then it doesn't have to be in writing. Isn't that inconsistent with what the legislature decreed?
No, I don't believe it is for the reasons that Mr. Moskowitz said. First of all, I admit, Your Honor, I have not had a chance to brief this, and so forth. It's going beyond my brief. But based on what I heard on the arguments here, Mr. Goldfarb wasn't going to be an outside investor with an investment firm like Morgan Stanley or Prudential or anything like that. He was going to be employed with a salary, with potential bonus and profit motives on top of that. So therefore, he was going to be subject to being fired as an employee. So that's far different than being an outside investment advisor with a investment advisor client relationship. Here he is an employee. He will be an employee, but he wasn't seeking damages based on that. He was seeking damages based on the fact that Solomon revoked the promise to employ him, and he relied upon that promise. And what was given to him, what was offered to him, was sufficient and definite enough for Mr. Goldfarb to resign his position at the prior employer, just as what happened to Ms. Peck in Peck versus Imedia Court. I don't see doctrinally how, if you were to rule that a promissory estoppel claim is encompassed because it's nothing but a contract claim, how you are not overruling Peck versus Imedia Court or Coxcomb.
Mr. Green, isn't your argument based on a lot of sophistry? You're basing it on what you call it rather than what the facts are to support it. You're calling it not a breach of contract, but a promissory estoppel. But essentially, the facts are the same. So isn't your argument premised somewhat on basically sophistry, what you call it, in order to get around the writing requirement?
No, it's not sophistry, because the remedy sought is not for a breach of contract, which was brought up in Pop Cones. I don't see how the court, if you're going to say that a promissory estoppel claim is just like a contract, and it therefore comes under the Jersey securities law, then you're basically eliminating a promissory estoppel claim as a separate cause of action.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Green.
Thank you.
No, go ahead. Take another minute, please.
Well, the other point I wanted to bring up, Your Honor, assuming that you affirm the liability verdict and assuming that it goes back down for damages, I realize in point four in my brief, I raised the issue of income tax returns in the framing. I framed it in terms of discovery, which I realize is not an issue here. However, it is important in terms of relevance. If in fact this case is remanded to the trial court for a trial on damages, what is relevant in terms of what the expert can testify to on reliance damages, which would be W-2s or Schedule C, goes and works in reverse in terms of discovery. 1040, Schedule 1040 is a compilation of all the schedules that are submitted by a taxpayer. In other words, if someone is self-employed, without being a partnership or a corporation, then they would submit a Schedule C. If they are in an LLC or a partnership, then they would submit a K-1. Or if they had their own corporation, then they would submit the corporate tax return. The point being is, and I remember reading the transcript of the 104 hearing, that the trial judge says, under no circumstances should an expert be allowed to testify without the full tax returns. And I think that goes to that argument, that goes to the point, should this case be remanded for trial on damages only? And that's the point. And then, of course, working backwards as to what is discovered, what should be discovered, it should be limited. In other words, the plaintiff has the burden of proof to prove damages, and they have to prove it with certain documentation. It should not require production of a submission into evidence or production during discovery of the entire tax return, of a spouse's income, of capital gains, of the deductions and things like that. It should just go to income and have whatever
documentation.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Understood. Thank you. Ms. Amalfi, brief rebuttal. We can't hear you, Ms. Amalfi. Are you on mute?
Oh, thank you. Sorry. This court should not use equitable principles to undercut the black letter law of this state. The legislature's put the obligation for a writing in the law, and they put it on Mr. Goldfarb. And this court should not use equitable principles to substitute its own judgment. In addition, Mr. Moskowitz briefly raised the waiver issue and said we had not raised this issue before, which is accurate. I would like to just mention to the court that the court should consider this as a matter of public interest. The family office exception is not part of the New Jersey securities law. To allow this case to stand with a finding that this investment advisor does not have to follow the law because he was going to work for a family office would be injustice and would be entirely inconsistent with the New Jersey securities law. Next, Mr. Moskowitz and Mr. Green both rely a lot on Pops Cones versus Resorts. I'd like to mention to the court that case had no consumer protection statute at issue there. The plaintiff in that case had no obligation to ensure that there was a writing. And I think based on those two facts, it's really not relevant to the issues before this court. With regard to Justice LaVecchia's comments with regard to the appellate division potentially going too far with regard to the expert issue, I would like just to mention to the court that since the appellate division ruled, Mr. Goldfarb has come forward with a new expert report. And so what the appellate division did not anticipate is, given the change of time and the change of circumstances, that a different opinion will be presented at the new trial. So obviously their exercise of original jurisdiction to say that the expert should have been able to testify as to the old report is really no longer relevant and should not be allowed. I'd also like to just mention that there appears to be a lot of argument that promissory estoppel is different than breach of contract. Here, not only are the facts identical, but here what the promissory estoppel they're relying upon is the very contract that they're claiming has to be in writing. And under Section 90 of the restatement, it specifically says that a promise that is binding under this section is a contract. And therefore, under the New Jersey securities law, it needs to be in writing. One second, I'm just going through my notes. The employer-employee relationship. There is nothing in this statute that exempts the employer-employee relationship. In fact, there are a number of exceptions of who is and who is not an investment advisor. The New Jersey legislature made very clear who is an investment advisor, who is not an investment advisor. At no point did the New Jersey legislature say someone who's going to work for a salary as an employee is not an investment advisor and does not have to get a writing. There's nothing in the statute that says that. Mr. Moskowitz's argument that it exempts someone from registering if there's five clients or less It does exempt them from registering. It does not exempt them from getting a writing. So I think you have to look at the plain language of the statute. Mr. Moskowitz also made a major argument that there was no dishonest practice by Mr. Goldfarb here. That is incorrect. The dishonest practice that was engaged in here is Mr. Goldfarb attempted to enter into a contract to provide investment services that was not in writing. That has been identified by the Bureau of Securities as a dishonest practice under the New Jersey securities law. And finally, Your Honor, on the tax return issue, the standard that this court has in place is good cause and substantial purpose. And that's from the Ullman case and from the Campione case. There's no reason for the court to revisit that issue here. Thank you very much for the time. And
I have one question. I have one question, Ms. Malfi,
sure.
If you can clarify this for me. Can the family office exception apply to individuals who employ an investment advisor as opposed to a company? Or does it have to be a company? Do you have any thoughts on that subject?
Both the statute and the CFR, to my knowledge, refer to the family office as a company. But I would like to also reiterate that in this case, the record indicated Mr. Goldfarb didn't know who he was going to work for. And one of the options was Core Insurance, which clearly is not a family office. Mr. Emil Solmein, Mr. David Solmein, another company called DSM. So the whole issue of whether he was going to work for a family office, while we claim the whole family office exception is irrelevant here, but if the court finds it is relevant, the testimony needs to be provided to the jury, and the jury needs to find whether, in fact, he was going to be employed by a family office or not.
I don't want to belabor this point, but are we putting too fine a point on this issue? The family exception, according to the CFR reg, is we're talking about a company that is wholly owned by one or more family members. No?
There's a number of items that you have to establish in order to prove that there's a family office. One is that you're going to work for a company.
I'm talking about A2.
Yes, and in addition to, and so it needs to be a company, whether organized or unorganized. It needs to be a company, a group of people, as I understand it, from the statute, which I'm just looking for here to pull up.
That's all right. That's all right. I understand your answer. Anything else, Ms. Amalfi?
No, thank you very much for the time, and I apologize again for the communication problem that we're having.
No apology, and I wanted to thank all counsel for the very, very fine presentation.